So good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to welcome our speaker today, Professor Lorna Woods from the University of Essex. I'm sure that many of you are already familiar with her work. She has published extensively in the fields of EU law, media regulation, and internet law. From my perspective, I've used her big book, EU law, many times, and I'm told it's now the 12th edition, and one more edition to go. That she's also published in a number of first-class academic journals. So I'm sure we are all very much looking forward to listening to her talk. She's going to talk about the audiovisual media directive. And I, for one, I'm really looking forward to hearing about it. So
thank you. I'm going to talk about the proposal to amend the Audiovisual Media Services Directive. Now, a lot of times when you get, communication specialists talking about this, they talk about the developments within the context of convergence. And I thought that I would look at it through the lens of competence rather than convergence. Because I think, as I think a lot of authors have noted, that there is a sort of drift, a drift upwards to the European level. You know, if you look at the literature on, say, multi-level governance or on soft governance, new institutionalisation and all these things, there is a sort of descriptive approach to it, which possibly comes from the political sciences, and that's fine. But we sort of have a sense that post-Maastricht, and particularly post-Lisbon, there's a sort of constitutional settlement as to who does what or where the powers are, that is in some way agreed. And that may be the case at treaty level, but I think that within secondary legislation, within directives, you can get perhaps greater intensity of harmonisation or a greater intensity of control over national policy choices. I also think that the media's an interesting area because it is not just an economic topic. It has links to culture, to the public sphere, even to identity, and therefore might be more sensitive for states. Particularly, you find that, there's two things. One, member states have very different ways of viewing media policy, and the traditional description given is that of the division between the laissez-faire approach, which is exemplified by the United Kingdom, provided you ignore the BBC, that is, and the French dirigiste, more interventionist, more seeing media as part of culture, patrimony, that sort of thing. So you've got a tension there, and also there is a link with member states' institutional and constitutional setups. And we see this when the directive first came in. The Germans had a problem with their internal division of competence. We've now got questions about what's going on in Hungary, what's going on in Poland, and that is all about the internal state of affairs within the member states. So there might be, a question about constitutional identity, not seen in the context from the ECJ and the treaty, but perhaps more in the context of the German Constitutional Court, its perception of state identity. So, as I said, I'm looking at competence in quite a broad and fluffy way, perhaps going back to what Estella was writing about when talking about this horizontal idea of competence and intensity. And we're looking at a proposal for a directive. So this isn't set in stone yet. So what I might be doing is more flagging up potential problems than sort of direct changes. And I should emphasise that when I talk about this, I am not looking at seismic shifts. This is very much incremental. And it isn't even necessarily a bad thing. If we flick our eyes eastwards to the issues in Poland, for example, maybe some greater Europeanisation of media policy may in fact support independence of the media, pluralism of the media. So it's not taking a value judgment about good, bad, or indifferent. So I guess I'm not talking to experts in media policy, so I'm just going to mention what convergence is because it's there in the background to debates. And it's been described as an elastic term. And it generally refers to the fact that what were historically separate services and quite often technologically specific services have now become joined, or the link between a service and a particular technology is no longer made. So broadcasting used to be via terrestrial analog airwaves. Telephones were cables. And so you had one technology for telephones, one technology for broadcasting. You've now got digitisation, you've got the internet, and you have got the possibility for services over different platforms, multiple services over the same platform, which raises questions as to should there still be differential regulation, and if so, to what extent. And that is the sort of convergence argument. You see it being blurred with ideas of level playing field. This is usually about industry players and the costs of a particular regulation for one actor over another actor. It also has a geographic slant as well, insofar as there is a difference between regulatory regimes. So it can mean both. And this idea of level playing field has underpinned the development and a lot of the changes that we see through the history of the directive, as you see in a load of the comdocs from the Commission paper on convergence in 97, through to more recent comdocs such as the paper on a converged continent, which is part of the digital single market. So I'll just run through the development of the directives to give you a background to what I'm going to say, and so you can see where the change is coming in. So the first version of the Television Without Frontiers Directive, as it was then known, came in 1989. It was part of the Single European Act initiative. But it was particularly triggered by case law on services, where the media sector was held to be within the scope of the treaty, but that regulatory regimes could in principle be justified in the public interest for media pluralism purposes, freedom of expression, blah, blah, blah. There was a concern, however, that there were consequently barriers, and particularly a very different approach across member states regarding the acceptability of advertising. And this was becoming more of an issue as technologies change, so as we get satellite coming in, as we get cable retransmission coming in. The directive as enacted was considerably broader than just controlling advertising. So it had negative content rules for advertising, it had frequency rules for advertising, but it also had negative content rules for content, by that I mean programs, and it also had some positive content obligations. And these are the infamous quotas for European culture for independent programming, known usually as the European quotas, and complained about by the Americans within the context of GACTS. These were contentious, and this is going back to the point that different member states had different views, and pre-Maastricht, there was no cultural competence in the treaty. So there was a lot of rumbling about the legitimacy of the directive, threats for member states to challenge on treaty base. It was made on the internal market for services provision, not 114. I can't remember the new number of that one, I'm afraid, but I'm sure you know the one I mean. There were also questions within Germany as to cultural competence, which sits with the Länder, not with the Bund, and questions about the signing of the treaty. At this stage, the directive constituted partial harmonisation of broadcasting regulation. So, for example, media ownership is outside. There were questions in the 90s as to whether the EU would have competence to regulate for that. Public service broadcasting, so the BBC, outside. And even within the content rules, it wasn't a full schema. So if we look at the regime in the UK, there are rules about the desirability of broadcasting aimed at children, about religious advertising, things like this. None of that was in the directive. So there is a whole chunk of, in particular, positive obligations that don't fit in the directive. It was minimum harmonisation with a market access clause. So it operates on the country of origin principle. That means the member state that in which the broadcaster is established regulates. The member state may impose higher obligations on those broadcasters within the member state, but cannot stop incoming transmissions regulated from another member state. There were derogations from this in limited circumstances. We have the first revision in 97, which gave rise to changes to the jurisdiction rules. There had been a lot of concern about abuse of the country of origin principle, whereby Luxembourg became a very popular place for broadcasters to establish themselves and use satellite. The UK also, because unlike a lot of member states, it did not prohibit, and still does not prohibit, the advertising aimed at children. So what you were getting is companies would come and set up under good old Ofcom, and then broadcast to France, to Sweden in particular, channels carrying advertising. So there was Recital 14, the amending directive, recognised this issue of forum shopping, and so you find more complicated rules coming in to prevent the abuse of the free movement principle. This was difficult. It sort of runs contrary to the idea of free movement of services, And all the arguments you get in Centros and the tax cases and those sorts of things could apply here. Interestingly, we get some more advertising rules covering teleshopping, which you can say, okay, this is another example of a response to changes in services. And you also get a provision allowing member states to regulate for events of major importance for society. So this was the rule that said member states could, in principle, prohibit a broadcaster from broadcasting an event, a listed event, for subscription. It had to be freely available. So this will be things like the Olympics or the FA Cup final. And I rather suspect that this was motivated by the UK, which had this sort of system historically. It was an option for states. So this is the beginning where we see a certain amount of optionality coming in. As a way, perhaps, to deal with differences in viewpoints. So member states didn't have to come up with a list. If they did, they notified it to the Commission to check that all was okay. The next revision is 2007, and this is when we see the Audiovisual Media Services Directive coming into being. We change television to audiovisual media services. And this was on the back of developments in the sector, obviously, between 97 and 2007, the environment changed radically. And so you start getting lobbying to say there are similar services on the internet to broadcasting regulated differently. The big surprise for industry was that when the European institutions agreed with this principle, they didn't roll back broadcasting advertising, but they rolled it out to cover a broader range of services. Collectively, these are audiovisual media services. The directive had what was called a graduated approach, in which it distinguished between old-fashioned broadcasting, known as linear services, and on-demand services. The rules from Television Without Frontiers were more or less rolled forward to the linear services, and lighter touch, real basics, just imposed on the audiovisual media services. Some information requirements came in too, and this is coming from the e-commerce directive. The e-commerce directive, amongst other things, requires information society service providers to say who they are. So these sorts of information requirements swim into the audiovisual media services directive. So here we have concerns about not wanting to stifle new developments in technologies and services while taking care of viewer or perhaps consumer protection concerns, and also, as I've said, a level playing field. Again, very different views from the member states about the appropriate level to take. And the definition of audiovisual media services was quite problematic. It has not been implemented uniformly across the EU, and national regulatory authorities seemingly have had a significant role in determining that. There's an increase in choice coming in here. So, for example, member states were permitted to introduce rules relating to advertising on products that are high in fat, sugar and salt, where the adverts are aimed at children. Also, introduction of the possibility of co- and self-regulation. Though the UK government commented when implementing that self-regulation just won't work for a directive, just as a matter of general treaty obligations. So, here we see shifts that I think follow the general trends that we see, and in particular the idea of co-regulation. Though the institutions do not seem particularly close on the difference between, if you like, bottom-up regulation that is then adopted by states, or mandated self-regulation, which is a form of top-down thing. The UK tried to create an industry body that it could then adopt, but that wasn't very successful, and it's all been rolled back into Ofcom. The market access clause and the anti-abuse clauses remained, but we see that there was a split. So you have one set of rules for the old television, one set of rules for the on-demand services. Interesting that it remains there. So now we come to the proposal for further change. The proposed change is part of the overarching review of the digital single market. And I think the Commission is trying to see how various directives actually fit together. And I don't think that historically they necessarily thought that much about it. We were aware that we had a horizontal split between telecoms and content, and we knew that the television rules were lex specialis as regards e-commerce directive, but precisely where the boundaries were never fully established. And things are going to just get more complicated with the new proposal. So what we've got is, yes, we've still got a country of origin principle. More work to be done on it, simplifying it apparently. They've removed the distinction between linear and on-demand, but Article 3.2, which contains the derogations, consolidates, and they seem to have gone for a position somewhere in between the two positions. So it means that as regards broadcasting, member states may have more room because there's more grounds for derogation, but as regards on-demand, less room because they've lost the consumer protection derogation. So derogations are now on Article 6, prohibition of incitement to violence or hatred, and or protection of minors, and then you've got public security and public health as derogations. There are still some differences in procedural requirements for the linear services. They've combined the approach to hate speech and protection of minors for the two types of service, and it's moving, as regards protection of minors, away from prohibited content and more to trying to make sure that minors don't see it. Majority of the directive is still minimum harmonisation, but now they have introduced some substantive rules which will be total harmonisation. So member states may not impose higher standards for the rules on exclusive events, rules on making available information for news reporting, the right of reply, which just applies to television as well, and video sharing platforms. In addition, they have introduced some provisions on the National Regulatory Authority. Previously, the directive assumed there were national regulatory authorities, but didn't say anything about them. There was a contact committee under the directive historically. They have added to this something called ERGA, European Regulatory Group or something. I've actually got the European Regulators Group for Audiovisual Media Services, ERGA. And that was set up in 2014 on a council decision, but it's now being re-established in the directive. So in here we see more references to codes of conduct, specifically Article 6A3 about making protecting minors, 9.2, which is the rules on high infection of foods. 9.4 refers to the facilitation of union codes. And there's also a reference to codes of conduct in relation to ads for alcohol, although in general the rules for advertising are more flexible. So finally, the degree to which the power, I think, is being shifted or constrained. I think there's three main headings, I suppose. One is the scope of the directive. Second one's the nature of the harmonisation technique. And in that I've got the idea of the distinction between minimum and total harmonisation, as well as the derogation procedures, and the extent to which member states are given choices whether to act or not. And then thirdly, the nature of obligations in the directive. And by this, I'm looking at the possibility for delegation or the possibility to use semi-soft law backed up with informational requirements going back to the Commission. So the scope of the directive, I don't think the internal realignment changes things. It may have, I think, changed the level of regulation, but I don't think it's changed the freedom of the state to choose. Though, if anyone wants to put forward a counter-argument on that when they've read the proposal, please feel free to say so. So mainly I'll be looking at new services and what I've called clarification. Some people say spillover. Clarification goes to the scope of the directive as was, so the 2007 version of Audiovisual Media Services, and what has been called the press exception in particular. Because the press weren't covered. The press wouldn't be covered, actually, as a matter of law, because they were a thing, goods, not services, but then we find them appearing online. And then we find them appearing online with videos. And is this an audiovisual media service? And the press were fiercely clear that they weren't. There was head-scratching amongst the national regulators. There were a couple of cases in the UK which ended up before Ofcom, which said, on the whole, no, because the length of the videos was too short to be a programme. A case went to the ECJ called New Media. That's case C34714 if you want to look at it. And that took a broader interpretation of what might be an audiovisual media service than certainly Ofcom had, and in particular, you look at whether the video is self-standing and length is not determinative. So this means that some bits of some press websites could well be audiovisual media services and not press. And the directive, the wording of the directive, is tracking the text of the judgment. So in this sense, it is limiting the discretion of the states there on how they regulate some aspects of the news media. The bigger, more high-profile change is an extension of the directive. The directive now applies in relation to two specific provisions to video sharing platforms. Now, these are not described as being audiovisual media services, so the rest of the directive does not appear to apply to them. It applies to something just described as a video sharing platform. Effectively, what they're trying to get at is YouTube and that sort of thing. There is going to be a lot of head scratching about whether the definition actually works and whether it covers, say, tweeting a link, those sorts of questions. But quite clearly, this is a shift. You could say, well, whoop-de-doo, they were already covered under the e-commerce directive. Why bother? Well, the fact is that the e-commerce directive did not really cover content. Here, Article 28A puts down some specific rules as to what video sharing platforms should have to do. With regards to essentially protection of minors, protection from hate speech, protection from incitement to violence. And this, though a totally badly worded provision as far as I can work out, I have questions about how it works, and if anyone can explain it to me again, I will be hugely grateful. It's total harmonisation, so it is removing the freedom of member states to do more as well as less. And whether you think taking action for video sharing platforms is limited to hate speech and incitement to violence and protection of minors may be a question where there are different viewpoints across the member states. Of course, it may depend what we mean by incitement, and there are references to illegal content and blah blah blah, but there are some questions there about what precisely is meant, and questions going forward about how the court would interpret those provisions. In Mesopotamia, in relation to a previous version of the directive, the court seemed to suggest that there was a union level version of hate speech and that member states should not take into account particular contexts of their own territory. So the Germans in that instance have been particularly concerned about, I think, Kurds and the content of satellite programming that was technically based in Denmark, I think. So that potentially changing things. As I've said, we've got a chunk of total harmonisation coming into what was formerly a minimum harmonisation directive. Minimum harmonisation has historically been seen as a way of allowing states to disagree, or if you want to put a positive spin on it, proportionality within a subsidiarity analysis. It's a more proportionate response because you are just targeting the issues that are going to be a real problem and you have a market access clause to make sure things flow. And some people have also suggested that this is a way of allowing cultural considerations to be mainstreamed, as we see Article 167 of the treaty. So allowing higher standards there. Article 28 may be the key provision that they are getting at. But what I think is significant is that the text doesn't say, oh, this is just about Article 28A. It's drafted so the default position in the directive is that it is total harmonisation, and that it specifically lists the clauses that are minimum harmonisation, or clauses in which you're allowed to take higher standards. Now, that for me raises a question about what the scope of the directive is, bearing in mind that there are huge chunks of media regulation that sort of sit on the boundary of the directive. If we go back to, say, my example of UK requirements for positive obligations for broadcasters who are public service broadcasters broadcasting children's programming. Now, there are provisions regarding children in the directive. Does that mean that's it for children in the directive, or is it just that's it as regards negative rules in the directive? And that shift, that move to default total, may have unintended consequences as a result. We do have some older case law regarding the scope of Television Without Frontiers and advertising. D'Agostini, for those of you who were lecturing Free Movement of Goods and Services. And there the court accepted that there was effectively, in relation to the market access clause, a distinction between general rules and media rules. But quite clearly the rules I am talking about are going to be considered media rules. So I think that's a little worrying, as well as the specific questions I have about what the wording of Article 28A means. There is a specific saving provision in 28A5, if anyone wants to go and read it, which says that member states can't impose more specific rules, but this doesn't affect rules relating to illegal content. What's that? Illegal content? Are we just talking general criminal? Are we talking just content rules, or are we talking procedurals? So rules, say, that might require platforms to put in place filtering or help buttons or hotlines or whatever. And if you look at the list of things that directive envisages, it is a question as to whether member states are going to be limited both substantively and procedurally. We have got considerable scope in here for codes of conduct, which will then be approved by the Commission in conjunction with IRGA. So this is moving us into the territory of double delegation that is talked about quite generally in relation to national regulatory authorities. And you see the discussion particularly in the telecom sector, possibly also data protection. And there is a question about the relationship between IRGA and Contact Committee, which I don't quite understand. Contact Committee is made up of a range of the regulators from the member states, as is ERGA. So I don't know whether it's because the Commission has more say in the structure of ERGA that it is viewed as perhaps being more a creature of the Commission, whereas the Contact Committee is seen more as an old-fashioned comitology style committee where the member states are influencing. I need to do some digging on that. But obviously it fits into a discussion where you see that trend through networking where you get, I suppose, an institutionalisation or a hardening of the European influence in these networks. And you can certainly see it in the telecoms field, because you used to have the European Regulatory Group and then you see it turning into BEREC. And now you see that the Commission wants an agency. So it's that trend. So question, is that what is happening here? And it's interesting because it seems like, because of the double delegation and because of the emphasis even on self-regulation, that the member state is dropping out of the picture. You're getting national regulatory authorities in ERGA, in a European context, and the Commission talking to industry players. Where's the state? Where's the recognition of individual state diversity there? That's just a question rather than a, you know, sort of alarm bell sounding the Titanic is sinking. There is probably more to be said, but I'd just like to touch on national regulatory authorities. National regulatory authorities theoretically fall within the scope of member state autonomy. So reference all that discussion about what that means. And on one level, what is not to like about a national regulatory authority, especially when it is independent? It's like apple pie and motherhood. Nobody can object to this. But there is a question about what this independence means and where these independent authorities find their direction. Are they finding their direction from the state, or are they finding it from the European rules? And to what extent can they overlap? If you look at some of the national regulators, you can see they have a mix of European and national powers. Ofcom's one. If you're saying it can't take instructions from anybody within the scope of the directive, it takes us back to what do we mean by the scope of the directive anyway. But it does then raise questions about the allegiance, if you like, or whether they have split loyalties. And this issue has arisen in the telecoms field. There is already quite a significant body of case law, including data protection, about what independence means and how member states must adapt their system. And although I haven't gone through all the European Parliament amendments on this, certainly the German rapporteurs on the topic have flagged competence concerns and wanted to delete the reference to independence here. Other regulators and ERGA have said independence is a good idea because of the problems in Poland and Hungary. So that is a brief summary of the independence question. There's one final point I'd make about that, and this is purely driven by parochial concerns. Coming back to the press, if they're partially regulate it because they are now partially under the directive, does this mean that the current system, for example, in the UK, complies with the directive? Does it mean that the UK government will need to specify who the regulator is? And there is case law from the communications field saying specification is required. Or does it mean that anybody who regulates a service that falls within the directive is a regulatory authority for the purposes of the directive and therefore must be independent in the context of the directive? And I question whether IPSA would be EU independent. So on that note, quick whistle-stop tour of my initial concerns about this. That's it.